Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, November 3rd, 2015. When it comes to the Keystone XL pipeline, Obama is the president who couldn't quite get to no.
Don't say no. Don't say no.
Oh, that's Billy Squire from back in the 70s somewhere. It's called Don't Say No. And you've probably heard by now that TransCanada, the pipeline operator that has been pursuing the Keystone XL, which runs through, what, six, seven states, down the center of the U.S. to Texas, where the tar sands crude from Canada would be exported. And yesterday, I got an email late in the afternoon. And the sender is DNC Rapid Response, Democratic Party at Democrats.org. Big news, Peter. The corporation responsible for Keystone XL has just suspended its request to build the pipeline. Earlier this year, thousands of Democrats backed President Obama when he vetoed Keystone XL. Did you hear that? We made our voices heard that we would stand up to protect our planet for future generations. Now, this is incredible. Because Obama vetoed a bill where the Republicans tried to force his hand and essentially, you know, violate the Constitution and give their approval to Keystone XL, which was not theirs to give. And the president vetoed that bill on February 24th, but he never said no to the Keystone XL. And they're trying to spin it that way now. And I really resent this, because it is an indication that Obama thinks that he can remain slippery on his approach to climate change, give speeches that the activists will listen to and say, yeah, he gets it, he understands. And Obama has articulated publicly all the reasons why he should have rejected the Keystone XL pipeline years ago. Now, environmentalists have bet the proverbial ranch using Keystone XL as a kind of icon, a poster child. And Bill McKibben defended that on this program a few years back. And he said, look, this is a decision that rests squarely with the administration. They'll either get it right or get it wrong. It's not a matter for Congress to weigh in. It is an executive decision. And so they were testing Obama, and McKibben tried to use sweet talk to get Obama to do the right thing. And Obama just gummed it to death and ran out the clock. Now, the Keystone XL may not be completely dead. The technicality that TransCanada cited is that, gosh, we're waiting for the Nebraska Public Service Commission to give its approval of the preferred route through Nebraska. And that's going to take a year, so we're asking the State Department to suspend our application pending the results of the Nebraska process. But they're really shopping for a new president. And it's interesting because while Obama never said no to Keystone, Bernie Sanders has always said no, and Hillary Clinton said me too to the Sanders position and kind of surprised us a few weeks back. So TransCanada is definitely looking for a Republican president to approve their Keystone XL pipeline. And again, it's just been mind-boggling the way Obama has talked around this issue, but never had the courage to actually make the decision and pay whatever political price might have occurred. And I mentioned earlier what the Keystone XL is designed for, and I want to note that the Guardian newspaper that I'm looking at their coverage of this on right now, got it wrong. It says Keystone XL was designed to pump crude from the Alberta tar sands for 1,700 miles across six American heartland states to refineries on the Gulf Coast. No, it's not going to refineries. It is going to be shipped out. That crude oil was never intended for the U.S. market and would have no impact on our alleged efforts to achieve energy independence. And the Keystone Pipeline, operated by TransCanada, does actually exist. This one leg that they want from Canada to Cushing, Oklahoma, is what is now in suspension. But there are plenty of ways that they can pipe that crude around without the Keystone XL. And because the price of crude oil has dropped so sharply, their imminent need for this pipeline has been sharply reduced. Now, the operator TransCanada is the subject of a new report from a Canadian government agency. It began with an investigation into an event in January of 2014 in the town of Otterburn, Manitoba, where one of TransCanada's pipelines produced a fireball. And it was one of 9 explosions and 65 fires that TransCanada's facilities have experienced since 2008. And 2 former whistleblowers interviewed by Vice News described rampant safety problems that they witnessed, including poor inspection practices, cracks in pipelines, inexperienced workers, and both were let go after they complained to the company about those issues. So the NEB, Canada's National Energy Board, released an investigation into these allegations and sustained many of them. And what they describe is this pattern of carelessness and just, it's about money. One of the whistleblowers say there is no inspection of the pipelines, really. The only inspection is get that bitch in the ditch, referring to the pipelines. And TransCanada can say whatever they want, but that's what they've done. Another whistleblower said that pipeline companies, including TransCanada, have poor welding practices, shoddy inspection, resulting in thousands of cracks in pipelines and time bombs all over the place. And perhaps you heard one of my interviews where we learned that the crude, this tar sands crude, is so sludgy and thick that it has to be heated and pressurized to 1,600 pounds per square inch in order to cram it through the pipeline. And that means that the pressure, when it hits a bad weld or a crack or a seam or any place where the oil can spill out, it's going to be a gusher. Now, it's interesting because TransCanada has often tried to position their safe pipelines in contrast to the dangerous bomb trains, these oil tanker rail cars that have been exploding all over the place. And I want to thank Carl Howard, who tipped me off to this story from the World Socialist Party, that last week when Obama signed into law a 3-week extension of the federal highway funding, there was a kind of secret clause in there that allows a lengthy extension of the federal deadline for railroads to implement a safety measure called positive train control. Now, originally, freight and passenger railroads nationwide were obliged to have it in place by the end of this year. But they got 3 more years, and they can get 5 if they just submit plans within 3 years. Now, for passenger rail, in particular the federalized Amtrak system, this is a huge cost, and they don't have the money. But let's put that aside, because the freight railroads, including Warren Buffett's BNSF, are swimming in profits. And they complain that their work towards the PTC system has cost them billions. And they're claiming that they will have to recoup their costs through massive staff reductions. But there is no excuse for this. And it's just another case of where the issues related to climate change and the true policies of the Obama administration are obscured and skewed in ways that show that he panders to environmentalists with a certain kind of rhetoric, and his actions clearly don't match that rhetoric. Today, I'm releasing to subscribers a powerful new in-depth interview at peterbcollins.com with filmmaker Stanley Nelson Jr. Nelson worked at PBS, worked with Bill Moyers. He's produced over a dozen powerful documentaries on important issues. He was a MacArthur Grant Genius Fellow a few years back. And his new film, a documentary, is called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. And I learned a lot from Stanley Nelson's film because I'm quite familiar with the Black Panther episodes in Chicago, the state-sponsored killing of Fred Hampton, which is accurately covered in Nelson's film. But because I was young and not paying attention, I guess, I was not that aware of the signal trial of 21 Black Panther members in New York who were dubbed the New York 21. And they were subject to the full effect of the FBI's COINTELPRO operations, trying to disrupt the black nationalist movement by pitting one against the other and by tying them up in lengthy trials. And as you'll hear Stanley Nelson right now explain, while the Panthers were all vindicated, every last one of them was acquitted in the New York 21 trial, the FBI ultimately won.
The top 21 people in the Panthers were arrested and put on trial, 156 different counts of conspiracy. And what that did, and kind of the strategy of COINTELPRO there, was to hopefully what will happen is, you know, you'll convict the people and they'll go to jail and that'll be that. But if you don't convict them, you tie them up in court, and you tie them up in court for long periods of time. So the trial of the New York Panther 21 went on for almost 2 years. It was the longest trial in New York State history to that point. People had hundreds of thousands of dollars in bail that they had to pay. They couldn't pay their bail. So now you have the leadership of the Panther Party in jail trying to fight these charges. They can't do any work. And finally, after this two-year trial, in a couple of hours, the jury comes back with 156 not guilty verdicts. And so everybody goes free. Nobody's convicted of anything. But, you know, it in some ways destroys the party, you know, in New York, because, the leadership is in jail for almost 2 years. But also, I think it's really important to understand is, you know, for anybody to join the Panthers at that point, you'd have to be crazy. You know, if you know that by joining the Panthers, you can be put up on charges, trumped up charges, and go to jail, that you're going to have to spend all this money to protect yourself, that this organization is riddled with informers, that, you know, why would you join? Why would anybody join this organization? So I think that, you know, even though the Panthers weren't convicted, in a large way, the COINTEL program of the FBI was successful.
You can hear the full interview with filmmaker Stanley Nelson. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com and all of our outlets. And this is where I pause to thank people like Steve Lane, Julie Dupree, Andy Krieger. Let me turn the page here. And Bob Donjakour. They're all monthly subscribers who have recently kicked in to the Peter B. Collins support plan here. And I encourage you to join them. I need your help to keep all this going. And by the way, I'm not really sure about my schedule on Thursday and Friday this week because I am moving the secret studio and my office all the way across the hall. And even though it's not that far, we've got to unplug everything and plug it back in. And my good friend Raul Velez, our chief engineer for PBC.com, is going to be here on Wednesday as we dismantle and reinstall. So just play it by ear. Thursday is a little iffy, and we should be up and running again on Friday. But I'd like you to join the effort to help me defray the cost of this move. We're going to upgrade some systems as well, put in some new gadgets, and it all costs cash. So become a subscriber. Go to peterbcollins.com. Click the menu tab in the upper right corner of the homepage. Next, you select Become a Subscriber, and from there you can choose $5, $10, $20, a $50 annual subscription. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount. Hey, and don't forget our new Zippy iPhone iPad app. It's available for $2.99 in the Apple App Store. Now, speaking of the FBI, speaking of its unconstitutional counterintelligence program in the 1960s, when we fast forward to 2007, the subjects of FBI overreach have changed, and the venues have changed, but the impunity and the arrogance have not. And today in the New York Times, Patrick Eddington, a former CIA employee who also worked as a congressional staffer for Congressman Rush Holt, tells the story of Amir Mashal, a man who lived in New Jersey and who was illegally taken to Ethiopia. He was picked up overseas, then taken to Ethiopia, where he was threatened with torture by American officials. And 8 years after his illegal rendition, his case ended up before a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. The questions include, can the United States government allow, facilitate the rendition of an American citizen to another country for interrogation? And can U.S. officials themselves conduct rendition and interrogations of American citizens, including threats of torture, on foreign soil? And Eddington concludes that based on the court decision, the answer is yes. If this decision stands, he writes, it'll mean that an American citizen overseas who's unlawfully targeted by the U.S. government for rendition, interrogation, and detention with the help of a local government will have no form of redress in the courts. Mashal was in Egypt in 2005 visiting family members. Then he went to Somalia and got caught up there in a wave of refugees, wound up in Kenya, interrogated by FBI agents in Kenya, rendered by Kenyan authorities back to Somalia, then sent to Ethiopia, a country he had never visited. The State Department formally protested the Kenyan government's rendition action and then sent FBI agents who got access to Mashal in Ethiopia and interrogated him there more than 30 times. They accused him of receiving terrorist training at an Al-Qaeda camp, and he denied, denied, and denied. And ultimately, he was released in May of 2007 and returned to the U.S. He has never been charged with a terrorism-related offense by the U.S. government. So he sued the four FBI agents who he claimed had detained him. And this gets into some legal arcana, but he made what's called a Bivens claim based on a 1971 Supreme Court case. But they denied him Bivens coverage because the Obama administration contends that the incident took place overseas and involved unspecified national security concerns. Now, this is another ugly case where our government has clearly violated the Fourth Amendment rights of Amir Mashal. And Eddington wraps it up by saying, Mashal has fallen into a legal black hole where the light of justice is extinguished in the name of national security. And this case, likely, it could be appealed to the full appeals court. It's likely not to be taken up by the Supreme Court. And so this will stand as another ugly precedent of the rollback of our constitutional rights under President Barack Obama. Today, Vice News is releasing the video report, I think it's about half hour long, that was produced by Jason Leopold. And it recaps the story of Sabrina D'Souza, who was part of the botched and bungled Italian caper in Milan, Italy, back in 2004, when we kidnapped Abu Omar in broad daylight, double-crossing the Italian authorities we said we had been working with on this secret plan. And Sabrina D'Souza is the odd woman out, a former CIA employee who was convicted by the Italians in absentia for her role in this caper. And she is now trapped in Portugal, where they grabbed her passport and are threatening to extradite her to Italy. It's a fascinating story. I will link to the Vice video report and encourage you to watch it when you have the time. Also, I'm linking in the show file for this podcast to a lengthy piece in the London tabloid, the Daily Mail. And it's rich in detail about Shaker Amer's first hours of freedom in Britain and how he got to meet his son, who was born on Valentine's Day in 2002, the same day that Shaker arrived at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And the story has a lot of details, for example, about how the U.S. continued to treat him as just a number, not a name. But when he got on the chartered aircraft that the British government paid for, and we should have paid for it, The pilot greeted him, "Mr. Ammer, welcome aboard." And just that little gesture was such a change for Shocker Ammer. He refused to eat or drink anything on the plane because he was still suspicious that the Americans might have some kind of an ugly surprise for him. And I just think that the emotion when he met his son Ferris, born while he was in captivity and they had never seen each other before, his other kids are almost adults, have grown up in his absence. And commentators in Britain note that Shocker Ammer is entitled to a £1 million payment from the British government, and he may win other damages as well. But we should be paying that. Maybe he deserves money compensation from the Brits as well, because he alleges that British agents came to Guantanamo and participated in grilling and torture. But fundamentally, it's our ugly liability, and we should not try to escape it. Over in the war zone there in Syria and Iraq, the U.S. is trying a new PR strategy that has already been exposed as all hat, no cattle, to borrow a Texas expression. And this is kind of parallel to the fiction of the Khorasan group that has been launched by the CIA and the Pentagon in the last year and a half. But we now have a new name for the rebels in Syria. They're called the Syrian Democratic Forces. And we have committed a new $100 million to train and equip them. But so far, the Syrian Democratic Forces, according to the dangerously liberal New York Times, they only exist in name. They use borrowed facilities, and even people who are allegedly members of this new coalition aren't terribly committed to it, don't trust the United States, and are operating with a whole range of different agendas. And this new pose is an attempt to try to mollify Turkey, because the real fighters in Syria are the Kurds who are being brutally suppressed inside Turkey and then killed when they're outside Turkey. Sometimes Erdogan, who just won re-election, kills them in Turkey as well. And we learn that the dominant Kurdish force, the YPG, will fight very hard, but they will not go into Raqqa and roust the members of the Islamic State. So it is a tragic comedy of errors that continues to play out, with all of these fantasies and fictions and pretense. Meanwhile, people are dying. They're fleeing the country. We've got the world's biggest refugee crisis since World War II. And so the U.S. goes for a PR facelift, as if that's going to make any significant difference on the ground. A senior U.S. military official says that the U.S. had encouraged the Kurdish militia to create an umbrella group that would make more sense to an international audience, and Kurdish leaders decided to call it the Syrian Democratic Forces. But the name of a subgroup of Arab brigades called the Syrian Arab Coalition was an American invention. It had about 5,000 fighters. Roughly 20% of them said they would defend their land but would not go on the offensive against the Islamic State. And we understand the Kurds have about 40,000 fighters. Islamic State, the estimates are 25,000. But this whole thing is just a very empty movie script with real-life consequences, because people die on a daily basis. Iranian state television is claiming that an American resident of Lebanese citizenship named Nizar Zaka, who's got a permanent resident status in the U.S., has been taken into custody in Tehran. He disappeared on the 18th of September. He was last seen heading for the airport to fly to Beirut, but never boarded his flight. State TV claims that Zaka has deep links with U.S. intelligence services and military. And while his background is a little bit bland, it does seem possible. And we still have no word on when Tehran will release Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post journalist who hails from my backyard here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And there are three others who are being held, U.S. Marine Amir Hekmati, Saeed Abedini, a pastor from Boise, Idaho, and a former FBI agent named Robert Levinson. Do you remember Ahmad Chalabi? Chalabi, his name was sometimes pronounced. He was the Iraqi opportunist who soaked the American government for hundreds of millions of dollars. He bilked us, and then he tricked us. And he provided some of the phony intelligence that the eager neocons in the Bush administration soaked up and spun out to justify the invasion of Iraq. And Chalabi, who was on the CIA payroll in the 1990s, he helped pass our congressional law, the Iraq Liberation Act in, what was that, 98? And he cultivated friendships with Dick Cheney and the whole gang of neocons. He was a willing tool. And he's admitted that he would do anything to get rid of Saddam and get the U.S. to come in and topple the government of Saddam Hussein. And so after the CIA got tired of him, the Rumsfeld Pentagon took him on. They were paying him something like $300,000 or $400,000 a month, as I recall. And while some of the money was squandered on gym memberships and trivial stuff, the real issue was that Chalabi was lying. The Bush people knew it. And they had this arrangement where he could keep lying and they would keep repeating his lies because those lies supported their intention to find some excuse, any excuse, to invade and occupy Iraq. And in reading his obituary, I was disturbed to learn that, like me, Ahmad Chalabi was a Jesuit high school graduate. He went to Baghdad College back in the 1950s. Yesterday, I decided not to run a story that had reached me that purported to be a list of American officials who are members of the Ku Klux Klan. The Hacktivist Collective Anonymous has announced that it has a list of Klan members and it's planning to release it. But somebody who's even more anonymous than anonymous opened a Twitter account called Operation KKK on October 29th and started releasing a list on Pastebin, a website, this past Sunday, November 1st. But the real anonymous people say that the anonymous people have the wrong list and are publishing inaccurate information. So I will not join that mess. The real anonymous says that November 5th, 2 days away, they'll release the information. And if it's credible, I will share it with you at that time. Last year, when Robin Williams took his life, I think many Americans felt a personal loss. And here in Marin County, California, where Robin was always around riding his bicycle, hanging out, popping in at local comedy clubs unannounced, we considered him a real local treasure. And it was very interesting because I would run into Robin in a lot of different places. I'd interviewed him before, but I always gave him his space. I'd say hello, but not impose on him. And he liked that. He understood. And now we're learning the details of what led Robin Williams to take his life last August. It was not depression, and it was not early-stage Parkinson's, as we were led to believe. His widow, Susan Schneider Williams, is giving interviews on the morning talk shows today. She said, "I've spent this last year trying to find out what killed Robin. It was not depression. Depression was one of, let's call it, 50 symptoms, and it was a small one." And after his death, she said that he'd been suffering from early stages of Parkinson's, but doctors later discovered a rare condition called Lewy body dementia. Lewy is spelled L-E-W-Y. She said, the widow, I know now the doctors, the whole team was doing exactly the right things. It's just that this disease was faster than us and bigger than us. We would have gotten there eventually. And she said that Robin started to show symptoms, high levels of anxiety, delusions, and impaired physical movement. He had one episode where he apparently ran into a door and bruised himself. And about 1.3 million people have Lewy body dementia. And that's news to me. I'd never heard of it before. And in honor of Robin, we're going to leave you with a smile on your face today. We'll give Roy Rogers the day off, because our friend Roy Zimmerman has just released a brand new song. And I love Roy. He's been my personal minstrel. He came with us to the Democratic Convention in Denver in 2008 when we did live broadcasts from there. And I'm going to link to the video that you can watch for free at YouTube, because there are sight gags and some audio clips of real people in his new song, which is called Donald McRonald, the face of the new GOP. Take it away, Roy Zimmerman.
Ronald said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Donald said, I'll build a wall and make Mexico pay for it all.
And I will have Mexico pay for that wall.
What's more Republican than a big orange orangutan? Rich, smart, and humble is he.
I'm really rich.
Donald McRonald, the face of the new GOP. Ronald said,
and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here.
Donald said,
they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
We love the way he's redefining the cloud around the silver lining so optimistically.
We're dying.
Donald McRonald, the face of the new GOP. We won for the Gipper.
I've thought a bit of the shining city upon a hill.
Now let's win one for the Freudian slipper.
I've said that if Ivanka weren't my daughter, perhaps I'd be dating her.
We won another one for the great communicator.
The maxim is, dovei, no provei. Trust, but verify.
Let's win this one for the great self-inflator.
Nobody can do that like me. Believe me.
Ronald said,
after 200 years, two centuries, she's still a beacon for all who must have freedom.
That's what he said. Donald said,
sadly, the American dream is dead.
From dogmatic ideologues to a pack of Pavlovian dogs drooling whenever we see Donald McRonald, the face of the new GOP. The message is drifting and warping and shifting. The party of Lincoln is shriveling and shrinking for Donald McRonald, the face of the new GOP.
I haven't heard the word clown in a while.